This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, in one of the most outrageous incidents of abuse in solitary confinement, a group of inmates known as the Dallas Six in Pennsylvania suffered extreme abuse and brutal treatment at the hands of prison guards.
No doubt the Dallas Six were tortured, 10 years or more in solitary. Sadly, this is a story replicated in thousands of prisons throughout this country.
We'll talk about Rutgers University inviting Condoleezza Rice for an honorary degree and to give the commencement ceremony speech.
Incredibly, the degree is a doctor of law. Here we're sitting here. It's an embarrassment to our profession. This is a woman torturer in chief. Let's hope that this invitation is rescinded.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, the United States government assassinated Alawaki and then weeks later assassinated his 16-year-old son. None of this has gone punished. What's the latest update?
Three Americans were killed by drones, at least that we're aware of. The center and the ACLU together have brought various lawsuits, first to try and stop the murders, and then to try and get damages. The three people who were murdered were Samer Khan, who is, quote, collateral damage, because he was with Anwar al-Awlaki when the drone hit Anwar al-Awlaki in Yemen. And then, a few weeks later, Anwar al-Awlaki's son, Abdul Rahman al-Awlaki, 16 years old, was killed by a drone. That the administration has no excuse for. They've never given a reason. He was sitting at a table in an outdoor cafe, a beautiful young man who you can see pictures of him in the film Dirty Wars by Jeremy Scahill. And so we brought various suits, as I said, to stop these killings. And now we had one to get damages for what we considered unlawful, illegal killings of three American citizens in Yemen. When we brought the initial case to stop Anwar's killing, we went into court on behalf of his father, Nasser al-Awlaki. The court said he didn't have standing to represent his son. In other words, his interests weren't significant enough to represent his son, which is complete BS reason. But in any case, we lost that lawsuit 2 weeks after the lawsuit, or roughly around that, Anwar al-Awlaki's drone to death in Yemen. We then brought these damage cases. We just lost those cases this last week. And the basis for those cases is completely and utterly outrageous. Our proposition that we tried at the center and the ACLU to put forward was that you shouldn't kill people, anyone, but of course in this case American citizens are particularly protected by a U.S. Constitution. You can't kill them without due process. Due process means that a court should have a right to say whether a person should be jailed or killed or whatever. So we went into court saying due process requires that you should have gone to court before you could get essentially a death warrant against Anwar al-Awlaki and, of course, the two, quote, collateral murdered people. The court said, well, there was due process here because the president designated Anwar al-Awlaki for death and Congress had broadly authorized the U.S. to go to war in Afghanistan, but actually in a war against anybody involved in the 9/11 attacks. And that even though these people are in Yemen and outside a war zone, that it was within that broad authorization, and once the president designated these people as terrorists, or particularly Anwar al-Awlaki, it was okay to do, and that's all you get in due process, which is remarkable, because certainly before 9/11, my understanding of due process was never that it didn't include a court. Since when can the president designate someone for death? And the most horrendous statement probably in the court opinion is this, quote, defendants must be trusted. The defendants here are the president, the CIA, and others. Defendants must be trusted and expected to act in accordance with the U.S. Constitution when they intentionally target a U.S. citizen abroad at the direction of the president and with the concurrence of Congress. So, in other words, it's trust them. A court doesn't have to interfere here, not interfere. A court doesn't have to examine it. A court doesn't have to judge. Just trust the government. So it's a really outrageous decision. The last time I came across a statement similar to that from the government was when we were arguing the cases 2004 around detention, Guantanamo, detention in the U.S., Justice Ginsburg asked the lawyer for the government, well, what if you're using torture at Guantanamo? What if you're using torture in keeping these people in these offshore prisons? And this was before Abu Ghraib. It's, you know, before all the revelations about torture. And the Solicitor General turns to Justice Ginsburg and says, well, we don't use torture. The United States doesn't torture. And then Ginsburg pushes and says, what if you're doing it, and what if you're just doing a little bit of torture? Do you mean a court would have nothing to say about that? And what did the Solicitor General, Paul Clement, get back and say? Trust us. Trust us. That night, the Abu Ghraib photos came on TV. So the idea that a court in this day and age is saying that the people of this country ought to trust the president in designating people for death is completely outrageous, just completely outrageous. It's a terrible blow. But, you know, if you put it in the context of what role the courts have failed to play, we've litigated now drones, this case, this last al-Awlaki case. We've litigated Guantanamo, indefinite detention. They're still sitting in Guantanamo. We've litigated torture. We've never recovered anything, never stayed in court on any of the torture allegations. We've litigated rendition, been thrown out of court on that. So essentially, the court have acted as protectors of this administration and the last administration and the one before that on all of the incredible illegalities of the war on terror.
Michael Ratner, I understand that Al Jazeera has issued a report on torture.
Well, it's an article which is leaked. It's by Jason Leopold for Al Jazeera, and it, based on leaked information of what is in the Senate Intelligence Committee report. Now, recall, that report is over 6,000 pages. It's been sitting in someone's desk for years. The CIA has opposed it coming out. The president himself has held back thousands of documents. They've also tried to prosecute people in Feinstein's office. It's not that the CIA wants to review it. It's that the Senate Intelligence Committee voted to declassify the executive summary of about 400 to 600 pages and 20 findings, not the 6,000-page report. Well, the first thing Obama did was assign the declassification job to the CIA. So, you know, you hear of foxes guarding the chicken coop? You know, come on, guys. So you're having the CIA basically declassify a report or part of a report that they're the targets of. But then the revelations or the leaks are starting to come out, and they're extraordinary. I remember when Guantanamo was set up, and of course the center where was the first place that litigated that, I took a trip to London, and everybody was screaming, well, it's not just Guantanamo, but we think they're also holding people at a UK colony off the India coast called Diego Garcia, not a colony, whatever it is, a possession of the UK. The British government said, no, no one's being held at Diego Garcia, etc. Well, now, two of the revelations that have come out of this report are extraordinary. One is that Guantanamo was actually used as a dark site. And what I mean by that, our Guantanamo detainees were held in very bad conditions, torturous conditions, but they weren't put into a special area called a dark site, which dark sites were set up in Poland, in Thailand, in, now we know, in Guantanamo, and in Diego Garcia. So it's going to be
secret sites
from anybody. So it'll be interesting to see what happens now after the British swore that Diego Garcia was not being used in that as such as a dark site. We don't know who leaked it. It just says officials who spoke on the condition of anonymity because of the 6,600-page report remains classified. So there were two of the revelations. I think my co-host, Michael Smith, has some more.
The Senate report allegedly accuses senior CIA officials of lying during multiple closed session briefings to members of Congress from 2003 to 2005 about the use of what they called enhanced interrogation techniques. Let's talk about what they are. We all know about waterboarding. But in one instance, they subjected one man to 11 consecutive days of being tied to a chair and doused with ice-cold water, not allowed to sleep, kept awake for 11 days, and then they played loud music to him. They stuffed him into a pet crate, you know, the crates that you ship animals on airplanes? They stuffed him into a pet crate Then they shackled his wrists and hung him from the ceiling. And then they played on a continual loop really loud music. And it came out that they played the Red Hot Chili Peppers, which may be torture. I don't know. I'm not familiar with the group. But in any case, this is the kind of stuff that they did. And they lied. They repeatedly lied about doing it. So this stuff is being leaked now.
In addition, the number of prisoners, they say, were at dark sites being subject to torture was more than 100. And they were held in secret prisons. They were subject to torture methods not sanctioned by the Justice Department. I like that. Some torture methods you can use. Some torture methods you can't.
Yeah.
So they even went to torture methods that the Justice Department didn't do. And what's also interesting in this leak is the Senate report allegedly notes that 85 detainees deemed low value went through black sites and were later dumped at Guantanamo or handed off to foreign intelligence services. Low value means they shouldn't have been taken in and tortured at all, not that anybody should. More than 10 of those handed over to foreign intelligence agencies to, quote, face terrorism charges are now, quote, unaccounted for and presumed dead, the U.S. official said. 24 of the men designated low value have been wrongfully detained, 24 of them, and rendered to other countries on the basis of intelligence obtained from CIA captives under torture. The whole program, I mean, it's completely amazing to read this about what happened in this country and the fact that it's being just brushed over.
Two of the countries that they shipped these people to be tortured were Morocco and Poland. And one of the things they're concerned about is that the Polish government didn't want them to disclose the fact that they were hosting these torture sites, but it's come out.
Hopefully this leak is one of the first and won't be the last. I expect many more leaks to come out, and it'll probably be more horrendous than what we've just told you.
Michael, hard to believe it's that time again. The Brooklyn Folk Festival is coming up.
6th Annual Brooklyn Folk Festival, April 18th, 19th, and 20th at the Bell House in Brooklyn. Old-time string bands, blues, jug bands, traditional Indonesian, Balkan music, New Orleans jazz, songwriters, and more. And a square dance, films, workshops,
but fun.
And a famous banjo toss. Ask me about the
What's
banjo toss.
What's the banjo toss?
They throw a banjo into the Gowanus Canal, which is a super fun sight.
Ruin that instrument.
It's a sacrificial banjo.
Okay.
But when they haul it in, they got to wear rubber gloves.
To protect themselves.
Last year, shot putter from Cincinnati won. And then you don't get the one you throw in the water. You get a new banjo for it.
Okay.
The Brooklyn Folk Festival, it's at brooklynfolkfest.com. It's presented by Down Home Radio and the Jalopy Theater. Down Home Radio is my son, Eli Smith, and they've got 30 bands. It's a terrific thing. Brooklyn is the center for the revival of folk music in America. So check it out, April 18th, 19th, and 20th, the Brooklyn Folk Festival.
It is an amazing event. I've gone every year and love it. And for you people listening who are over 65, which I know are some of our listeners, there's a smaller banjo they give you to throw. I almost won last year with the tiny banjo.
I don't get why the older people have a smaller banjo.
Because the bigger one is heavier. It's harder to throw.
In April 2010, a group of inmates locked in solitary confinement at SCI Dallas Prison in Pennsylvania suffered so much abuse and brutality at the hands of prison guards that they placed bedding over their windows to attract attention of prison administrators. But instead of receiving assistance, these inmates were brought up on riot charges. Last December, the prisoners, known as the Dallas Six, defended themselves and presented testimony describing the details of their abuse in solitary. To give us an update on the case, we're joined today by Chandra Delaney, mother of Carrington Keys, one of the Dallas Six. Chandra Delaney, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
We've covered cases on Law and Disorder about abuse of prisoners across the country, but it seems that Pennsylvania has been especially strict, and we wanted to hear the details of the so-called Dallas Six. What happened?
This case for the Dallas Six began back in April of 2010. These men were all in the RHU in SCI Dallas in Dallas, PA. And the RHU is Restricted Housing Unit. It's just an acronym for solitary confinement. All of these men had been victims of abuse and different tortures throughout their stay in solitary confinement there at Dallas. The guys' names, the Dallas Six, are Andre Jacobs, Anthony Kelly, Anthony Locke, Dwayne Peters, Derek Stanley, and my son, Carrington Keys.
How long were they in solitary for?
It was different periods of time, but from what I found out, most of these guys went into solitary for maybe like minor infractions and maybe to stay 60, 90 days, but all of them stayed in there at least, like my son stayed in there almost 10 years, and I think all of the other guys about the same.
Wait, 10 years?
Right. It's because these guys were jailhouse lawyers. These guys were people who spoke up and sent word to the outside about what was going on in solitary confinement. And once you start doing that, they make up, they call it misconducts, which are just write-ups. They'll give you false write-ups and all type of things just to keep you in there longer.
You know, I can't believe the 10 years. Can you describe what the prison is like, what the cells are like?
Actually, the cells are 6x9. That's an average size. They're like 6x9. In solitary, they might have a window to the outside. They may or they may not. There is still like a bunk that they sleep on, and there is only a slot for food to come in and out and a small window for the guys to come up to and talk to the people on the outside, you know, the guard or the nurse or whoever is going by the cell.
So you're saying 10 years in a cell like that is what happened?
Yes, yes.
Even if they get some exercise, 10 years like that is remarkable. But what kind of program is there for getting out or going into a yard or visiting their neighbors or talking to other inmates?
When you are in solitary confinement, at least from what I know in Pennsylvania, you're supposed to come out of your cell for 1 hour a day. They don't even let them get showers. They may get a shower like twice or two or three times a week. The only way they talk to one another is to yell, you know what I mean, to yell across, you know, to yell out. As far as exercise, the guys say they take them to a cage that it's not really outside, but you just get to come out of your cell into another, basically another cell that's a little bit bigger than your cell you're in.
Is that outside?
No, it's not outside. They don't even get to go outside.
Are they allowed visitors? What's the food like? Do they get phone calls? Can they write? Do they have books? I mean, what do they do when they're in that cage?
Okay, when they are in solitary confinement, well, as far as my son, they lied to me for years and told me that he wasn't allowed visits. But I later found out that they are allowed one visit a month. They are not allowed phone calls. I mean, you may, like if there's a death in the family, they will bring your loved one, to the phone so that you can relay that message. As far as the food, some guys, I remember my son telling me that he might have only gotten like an apple or something for a meal. And as a retaliation in solitary confinement, at least for what these guys had went through, sometimes they were refused meals. They did not stop and give them a meal. I mean, my son lost up to almost 20 pounds while he was in there.
These details are sobering, depressing, and in violation of human rights laws.
And they are torture, as
and
you
they
said.
Are torture.
And they have to be brought home because this is in Pennsylvania, yeah. And this is also throughout the country. Yeah. This country is insufferable on this issue, so
right.
I really appreciate
but
you doing this.
But I think the facts of this case are also disturbing. So in April 2010, the group, in effect, put bedding over their windows to protest?
Yes. What had happened was the group that I work for, Human Rights Coalition, the guys had been sending us information. Well, actually, we collect information from all the prisons. We do abuse logs. So from the information that was sent from SCI Dallas for over a year period, a 93-page report was written called Resistance and Retaliation. They sent a copy back in, but they did not, you know, nobody was thinking, they did not mark out the guys' names. So once the guards got a hold of this and saw the guys' names, they started one by one, you know, beating guys. They held one guy, Isaac Sanchez, they took him and put him into a restraint chair, and you're only supposed to be in the restraint chair for like 2 hours. They kept him in there overnight, and from what the guys say, he almost died. So they told the guys, oh, you know, we're coming for you. So in order to bring attention from a lieutenant or a superior officer, you have to cover your cell window. That's the only way that someone will, you know, will come to your cell. So the guys covered their cell windows, and since they had, I mean, they saw them going in one by one beating people, they barricaded their doors, and they covered their cell windows. So when the guards came, you know, down saying, remove the stuff from your window, the guys were like, we will not remove the stuff from our window unless you bring in someone from the outside. They wanted someone from the public defender's office and someone from the courts to come in so they could tell them what was happening to them. So the guards, you know, they said, no way are we going to do that. So what they did was go up and put on riot gear. They came down, and one by one, they went into the cells, and they beat these guys. I mean, they beat these guys very bad, and it's all on videotape, and we actually do have the videos of each of the cell extractions.
How did you get those videos? Through legal proceedings?
They were, yeah, through legal. Mm-hmm. When they came in there beating the guys, they were using the taser on, they tasered a lot of the guys in their genitals.
Oh.
The guys had burns on their bodies and stuff from the tasers. They pepper sprayed the guys, and then they once they extracted them, when you get extracted, they take you out. They have you like a hog or something. I mean, I saw everything on the video. They get you, and they take, like, I don't know what, if it was a razor, but they cut the clothes off of the guys, and they have them bare naked, and they throw them in a cage. They left all these guys in cages, some of them for up to 12 hours, bloody. None of them got medical treatment. They moved all the guys. Like, the next day, they emergency evacuated the guys to different prisons except for one. And I really think they emergency evacuated them because they probably felt that these guards were going to kill these guys. Once the guys got to their, you know, their new places, they all contacted Human Rights Coalition. So Human Rights Coalition took the information that they had and filed a criminal complaint against the Department of Corrections for the abuse and for the beatings of the guys. And my son, he also filed I don't know if it was a criminal complaint or a lawsuit, but he filed something against the Luzerne County District Attorney at that time. Her name was Jackie Musto Carroll. So HRC gave this information to the state police. So what happened, the state police took the information they had and turned it over to the DOC. Mm-hmm. So these three entities came together, the DOC, Jackie Musto Carroll, and the state police. And they charged the guys with the riot in retaliation for the guys filing complaints against them.
How are people like you and us who want to help, what's the fight back? What's going on?
Right now, May 5th is supposed to be the official trial date, but this official trial date has been going on for about 2 years. We've been going into court, and every time we go in, we find more and more discrepancies, and the case has to be postponed. What we're trying to do right now is my son, Carrington Keys, he wrote a 7-page summary about all of the illegal actions or whatever, and he is asking for us to turn this over to U.S. Attorney Eric Holder to ask for an indictment of all those who are involved under the RICO Act, because they have all worked together and pushed this thing through the courts. And if you were there, every time I go to court, I try to take notes, because there's so much illegal stuff going on in the court. Like, one of the guys was never even arraigned. And when he spoke up about it, Judge Gelb said, you know what you're charged with, so there's no need for that. I mean, everything these guys state, case law after case law to her about what they're doing wrong, and her response to them is, just appeal it. You can appeal that. Do that in appeal. Take care of that in appeal. Like, she's not answering anything. She's just telling them to appeal everything.
We're speaking with Chandra Delaney, the mother of Carrington Keys, one of the Dallas Six, who's been in solitary confinement in Pennsylvania in the prison there for 10 years. Chandra, is there a website for the Human Rights Coalition that you work with that our listeners could be in touch in?
Yes. The Human Rights Coalition is hrcoalition.org. And the $6, I have a blog for the $6, and everything you need to know about the case is on there, and I try to update it every time I get new information. The $6 blog is sci6.blogspot.com, and that's the number 6. So it's sci6.blogspot.com.
Chandra, how is Carrington holding up, and as well as you and the other family members?
I'm doing pretty good now, because as of 2012, he finally put in enough lawsuits and complaints that they actually put him in a step-down program, and he's out of solitary. So, yeah. That's making me feel better, because I swear I was praying every night, hoping the phone didn't ring and they tell me that they killed him, because of some of the stuff that they were doing. I mean, they took him out to shower and they threw him down the steps and broke his nose. They broke his teeth. They busted his teeth out with the stick before. And the way he got to Dallas was he was at Monoy and they had kept putting stuff in his food. And during that time, Jeffrey Beard was secretary, and I'm telling you, I was on a personal basis with Jeffrey Beard. I was calling him every week. I was writing him, faxing him. When my son told me about the glass, I called Jeffrey Beard, and I said, please, get my son out of there, because if you don't, he's going to be dead, and then that is going to be on your hands.
So they were putting glass in his food, shattered glass?
He found glass in his food. And, I mean, I'm telling you, from working with HRC, this is not a single incident. They do this everywhere. They do this everywhere. The guards, if it doesn't happen in general, but if the people that are in solitary confinement in Pennsylvania, they are truly being tortured.
I understand that you recently went to Washington, D.C. Was that related to the solitary confinement issues?
Yes, it was. Senator Dick Durbin held a judiciary hearing there about solitary confinement. So I went, you know, just to be a part, and I had submitted written testimony to him. He did it in 2012. I submitted testimony then, and I submitted testimony this time as well. And also, I had wrote him. It was just very, it was uncanny because I wrote him, Senator Franken, and the senator from Hawaii. All three of these people were on the panel. I wrote all of those all three of those people, like, I'm telling you, like 2 weeks before this hearing. So I was very happy that the hearing came about, and I was happy that I was able to attend and submit testimony. And he says that he will be, he said, this is just the beginning of the conversation. We're going to continue on. So I'm hoping that I can be on the panel the next time that they, you know, that they convene.
I hope you can be as well. And we on Law and Disorder want to stay up to date with this case as it develops. So we really thank you for going through this ordeal, keeping us informed, and we'll try to help, you know, mount the public pressure to raise awareness of this.
And Chandra Delaney, we'll link to your blog spot on lawanddisorder.org. We're very grateful to have you as a guest on Law and Disorder.
It's a horrendous story, and your courage in the face of it, and of course your son's, is remarkable. So just keep fighting as you are.
Yes, I will. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you, Chandra. Take care.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Condoleezza Rice was once the national security advisor for George Bush and then his Secretary of State. In that office, she both condoned, facilitated, and ultimately sought to justify torture. Nevertheless, the president of Rutgers, in a hand-picked small committee, secretly invited her to deliver the commencement address on May 18th at Rutgers in New Jersey. She's been awarded not only $35,000, but an honorary Doctor of Law. In response to this, students and faculty have been organizing to get her disinvited. We speak today with Rutgers University Professor Deepa Kumar, who's active in the campaign to disinvite Condoleezza Rice. Professor Deepa Kumar, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Deepa, you're a professor at Rutgers, and I understand on Commencement Day you're going to be joined by the secretly invited Condoleezza Rice, who's being awarded an honorary Doctor of Laws and given $35,000. How did that get past the students and faculty at Rutgers?
That's an excellent question, Michael, because in fact it did not get past students and faculty at Rutgers. Historically, our process at Rutgers University has involved having 20-some faculty, students, involved in a process of selecting the commencement speaker, typically by canvassing students, by canvassing faculty, and then making a recommendation to the president as to who to invite. What happened is that when President Bocci came to our university in 2012, he completely violated this open and democratic process, formed a committee of six people. One of them was himself, so he kind of put himself in a position to advise himself. And then they decided to go ahead and, you know, invite Dr. Condoleezza Rice. Now, we believe that this was actually politically motivated. We are trying to get to the bottom of this. But what we suspect is that Chris Christie, who was riding high at that time in 2012, this was before Bridgegate, very likely wanted to tap Condoleezza Rice to be his vice presidential candidate when he, you know, runs for president. And that's basically what happened in, you know, in a gross violation of the democratic procedures that we have at Rutgers.
Deepa, before we go into why this is a problem and what Condoleezza has done in violation of international law, what is the response? Are protests being planned?
So far, we have taken out a petition drive. The students have their own petition drive. The faculty have their petition drive. Hundreds of people have signed up. There have been public forums discussing this issue. We have also talked about the idea of holding a protest outside. Should our efforts fail, either holding a protest outside or inside the commencement ceremony. The last time that Dr. Rice was invited to be a commencement speaker was in 2006 at Boston College, where everybody turned their back when to her when she started to speak. You know, the only other place that has given Dr. Rice an honorary degree is SMU, which happens to be the home of the Bush Presidential Library. So it's really an embarrassment for us that Rutgers is joining the ranks of, you know, places like SMU.
Deepa, when Rice was first the national security advisor to Bush and then later on his Secretary of State, what did she do to merit this huge reaction at Rutgers? What are you saying she did wrong?
Well, first and foremost, I think the Iraq War is now widely understood to be a war that was based on downright lies. The Bush administration basically took us to war on the charge that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. As we know, of course, Iraq did not have even a single weapon of mass destruction. And as a member of the National Security Council, and then later, of course, as Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice was very much a part of this process of lying, of systematically lying to the American public. And quite frankly, we at Rutgers teach our students to be ethical, to be responsible citizens, and to invite somebody who has, you know, so willfully lied to the American public to be a role model, which is, you know, what a commencement speaker is, I think is a travesty. At Rutgers, we have a 44% minority student enrollment. It's a very diverse school, and I welcome African-American women as commencement speakers, but I think there are better people, people like Anita Hill or Angela Davis, who would represent the best of what this country has to offer in terms of people standing on the right side of history.
Deepa, you mentioned as your first reason for not having Condoleezza, which I agree with, is the Iraq War, which has possibly killed a million people. And I know we're going to talk about the Senate report, but one of the leaks from the Senate report is very relevant to that. And the quote from Al Jazeera is that the Senate report, according to Al Jazeera sources, say that the CIA interrogators were under enormous pressure from top agency officials, themselves under pressure from the White House, which is where Condoleezza worked, to use, quote, enhanced interrogation techniques to obtain information from detainees connecting Iraq and al-Qaeda. So this was obviously a major effort to use torture to try and make a connection that wasn't there.
Absolutely right. This is actually also another key issue why we are pushing to disinvite Condoleezza Rice is because she was very much part of sanctioning the entire torture regime. Essentially, in 2002, we know from a Senate Intelligence Committee report of 2009 that when Rice was chair of the National Security Council, she gave the go-ahead, a verbal approval to the CIA director at that time, George Tenet, to go ahead and use what they call, of course, enhanced interrogation techniques, which is essentially torture. And she has been, you know, quite steadfast in defending the use of torture. Even in 2006, when one of her top aides actually changed his mind and he said practices like, you know, waterboarding, putting people in painful, stressful body positions, depriving them of sleep and food and so on. These things, in a legal memo, he said, this is Condoleezza Rice's top aide, he said that such practices can be considered cruel, inhuman, and degrading, and he came out against it. And of course, you know, and even went so far as to call it a felony war crime. But yet, you know, Condoleezza Rice continued to support torture. In fact, she gave a speech at Stanford University where she argued that if torture was authorized by the president, then it doesn't violate the Geneva Convention against torture, right?
Yeah, that's one of the great ones. Yeah. That's like a Hitler-esque, actually.
Well, that's what Nixon said.
Exactly.
That was the rationale for what Nixon did. If he said it was okay, then it had to be okay. Can you tell me what day the commencement address is, if our listeners want to participate in the welcome?
Sure. It is on May 18th, and it will be held at Rutgers University. And I just want to say, to finish off the comment from the question you asked me last time, again, I want to emphasize this point, you know, given that Dianne Feinstein, who chairs the Senate Intelligence Committee, last week said that they are going to be releasing a 400-page summary of the torture that took place, at black sites all across the world by the CIA. And she called this, the use of torture, a quote-unquote dark chapter in the history of this country. And clearly, torture is a violation of international law, of the Geneva Convention. And I think that to confer a Doctor of Laws degree to someone who has been intimately connected with this quote-unquote dark chapter of our history, I think is a serious embarrassment for Rutgers University. And I'm really proud to be a part of the hundreds of faculty members and students who are actually standing up against this to try to disinvite her if possible, but if not, to try to organize a protest when she actually comes out.
Deepa, I'm holding in my hand an open letter that a colleague of yours at Rutgers wrote, Professor Jackson Lears, who's a distinguished professor of history at Rutgers, has been there for 30 years. He was not consulted in the choice of Condoleezza Rice. And, let me read you the conclusion of his letter and then read you a sentence that he wrote that I'd like you to comment on. He concludes that torture is not a partisan political matter. It is a legal and moral matter. Cruel and inhumane punishment is not only an offense against the United States Constitution and the Geneva Conventions, it is an offense against the fundamental standards of human decency. And then he concludes his letter, Dr. Condoleezza Rice sanctioned the use of torture and has continued to defend it even after her top aide warned that she and her colleagues were violating the law. To invite her to address the Rutgers graduating class and then to award her a Doctor of Laws degree, honoris causa, is a travesty of all the ideals this university embodies. I urge you to rescind your invitation to her, he asked the president. And then he says, and I want you to comment on this, as recently as April 2013, only a year ago, in a video meant to accompany the opening of the Bush Library in Dallas, Rice defended the administration's torture program, saying it kept us safe in the years following 9/11.
Well, I'm not surprised to hear that, Michael, because if you look at some of the responses in the aftermath of Feinstein's statement last week, Dick Cheney actually came out and defended the torture program, even now continues to defend the torture program, saying that if he had to do it all over again, he would do so. And so I think there's a certain way in which the officials who were part of, you know, the Bush administration's regime's efforts to make war around the world and to institute this torture regime and so on are unrepentive of what it is that they've done. There's a documentary also on Rumsfeld, which I caught a snip of, where again he says that, you know, he absolutely has no problem with the use of enhanced interrogation techniques. And so I haven't seen what Condoleezza Rice has said since last week. I don't think she said anything, but the what you mentioned from last year, I think, is indicative of how people in the Bush regime are completely unapologetic about, you know, this completely blatant violation of international law.
You know, one thing, Deepa, when Michael read the end of that letter and you made the comment, it talks about how the CIA and others claim that torture works. And in some of the leaks that are starting to come out of the Senate Intelligence Committee report, and we're not going to see that much, I think, because the classification is going to be going through the CIA. They're only declassifying executive summary, and it's going to be months, but it's starting to leak like crazy. And this one comes out of an Al Jazeera piece, and it says the report, speaking of the Senate report, not only accuses certain CIA officials of deliberately misleading Congress, Al Jazeera sources say it also suggests the agency sanctioned leaks to selected journalists about phantom plots supposedly disrupted as a result of information gained through the torture program to craft a narrative of success. So, I mean, what can you say except that's – can comment on that, but that seems to verify what the letter says and the outrageousness of inviting Condoleezza Rice.
Absolutely right. I mean, you know, what commentators have observed is that, in fact, torture didn't really lead to any significant leads in the hunt around Osama bin Laden and what have you. Torture doesn't work. That has been quite well established. And to, as you say, to then stage these spectacles in order to justify it is just, of course, shocking, but then, you know, somewhat unsurprising given the history of the CIA. There's actually a book by Trevor Aronson where he talks about how the entrapment cases involving Muslim Americans who, you know, very often are poor, are vulnerable, and so forth. Most of these cases of foiled terror plots, he argues, actually are cases where the entire plot was a result of FBI agent provocateurs actually going in and making, you know, a plot in the first place. So I'm not surprised that to hear the report that you are reading from Al Jazeera.
Instead of having prosecutions for violation of domestic and international law, there have been zero prosecutions. And now one of the chief criminals is being given an honorary Doctor of Law degree by the university where you teach.
Deepa, is it standard practice for the university to award fees for speakers in that amount, $35,000?
Yes, it is.
You work out in New Jersey. What do you think the chances are of A, Condoleezza Rice getting the $35,000 and giving the talk, and B, Christie, who was looking to have her as the vice presidential nominee, of Christie getting the nomination for president?
Well, I hope that if we keep up our activism, if we keep educating people about what the Bush administration has done and the part that Condoleezza Rice has played in all of this, that we can actually succeed in disinviting her and rescinding the offer to award her a Doctor of Laws degree. As for Christie, I mean, you know, he continues to be optimistic about his chances. After all, his lawyers cleared him of any wrongdoing in the Bridgegate, and that's all we need, right, is, you know, people's own lawyers deciding that they're innocent of any wrongdoing. But let me just say this. We're talking about torture and all the rest of it. I don't want to suggest that somehow the Obama administration has been sort of champions of this whole process, because McClatchy actually did this story, this investigative story, which suggests that even though in public the White House has appeared to support the Senate Intelligence Committee's work, in fact, for more than 5 years, the White House has been withholding about 9,000 top secret documents that the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence has been asking for. And now, of course, the Obama White House wants to send the 400-page summary to the CIA for its approval. And as one of you mentioned earlier, not a single official who's responsible for the torture regime has actually been held responsible. If anything, they've been exonerated. So I think this is a dark chapter, as Dianne Feinstein correctly puts it, in American history. But the question is, what is being done? And if we continue to, you know, invite people like Rice to universities, liberal arts universities like ours, and pretend she's not a war criminal and be held accountable, then I think what we're doing is papering over this dark chapter and setting the terms for this to happen again.
You know, I think that's really right, and that's why I think prosecutions are so critical. And the fact that they make it into a political football rather than something that's clearly illegal and immoral and give people like Condoleezza Rice degrees is horrible for thinking about the future. But in reading some of the leaks from the Senate report and thinking about some other issues concerning torture and Guantanamo, she calls it a dark chapter, but it's a dark chapter that's continuing. It's not over. It's not over partly because Condoleezza Rice can still get an honorary degree, and it's not over because there's still 155 people sitting at Guantanamo, many of whom went through torture regimes. So as long as that continues, whether it's there or in Bagram or in other institutions around this world and this country, this dark chapter is not over by a long shot.
I absolutely agree. And in fact, troublingly, even though we hear that the Obama administration ended torture and waterboarding and the black sites, investigative reporters like Anand Gopal as well as Jeremy Scahill have found evidence of the continuation of black sites in places like Afghanistan and Yemen. Now, there is no systematic study as yet that's been done, but there have been these kinds of reports that suggest that, both directly and very often indirectly through allies and the use of their agencies, the sort of torture of the U.S. enemies has continued.
At the end of March of this year, Condoleezza Rice was scheduled to speak at the University of Minnesota, where she was, I think, going to get $150,000. Now, students protested there. I assume she went through with the talk, but it's worth noting that a representative of the school told the local newspaper that rescinding her invitation to speak would be inconsistent with the university's goal of promoting discussion and dialogue.
Well, that's exactly the line of argument that they're using here as well at Rutgers. They're saying this is an issue of free speech. This is an issue of academic freedom. And those of us who are opposed to her are, people who want to stifle speech and who are racist and so forth. And I think it's very important to point out that a commencement, unlike an invitation to give a lecture at, a university forum, a commencement is a very different thing. It's a speech where there is no response. That is to say, we cannot stand up and challenge Condoleezza Rice for her record, for what she stands for, and so forth. So it's one thing to invite her to come and speak, and then to have all of us be able to produce the kind of material that Jackson Lears and others have talked about in relation to torture as well as the Iraq War. That's one thing. But we are fundamentally opposed to her coming to be the commencement speaker. And I think this idea of academic freedom and free speech and so on is frankly being used by, right-wingers who have harassed all of the faculty who are responsible for this petition. We've received dozens of hate mail, and including voicemail, threatening voicemail messages, including myself, saying that we will be, quote-unquote, taken care of, whatever that means. And, of course, these are the people who hide behind the shield of free speech and academic freedom and supposedly their concern about issues of race and racial diversity, when, in fact, this is really, entirely about a right-wing Republican agenda. And I want to tie this back again to the to what I started with, which is that Christie, of course, when he was riding high, wanted to use Condoleezza Rice to tap her as his running mate. And that's where a lot of this is coming from.
I think the difference between commencement and having a speaker on campus is crucial. And I take hope, even though it's one of the few acts this university has done recently that are any good, which is Brandeis had invited Ayaan Hirsi Ali to be their commencement speaker. And she's, noted hater of Muslims. I mean, says we're at war with Muslims, basically, is one of the worst, most inflammatory speakers against the Muslim religion you can find. Brandeis invites her to be the commencement speaker and got so much opposition that they disinvited her yesterday. And they disinvited her with a statement that said, this is not about free speech. This is about a commencement speaker. And we've decided, yes, she can maybe able to come here and speak on her issue, but she can't be the commencement speaker. Of course, it took huge pressure, but that's really in some way precisely what is going on at Rutgers. And so I think it's a good rejoinder for people who claim that this is about free speech, what Brandeis did, which is no liberal institution.
Absolutely. I think that Brandeis has set a really excellent example for us at Rutgers to follow. I mean, I write about Ayaan Hirsi Ali in my last book, and essentially how, as a black woman, she provides a cover for the kind of anti-Muslim racism coming out of, you know, the political establishment by saying, you know, I know because I lived with Muslims and they are actually horrible people, and that's why we should go off and, you know, make war and conquer them and all the rest of it. And she has been a poisonous figure in that regard. Unfortunately, the corporate media have given her a huge platform, calling her even, you know, the New York Times called her a feminist. This has nothing to do with feminism, you know, raining bombs on Afghan women as a way to, quote-unquote, rescue them. That has nothing to do with feminism and everything to do with empire and imperialism.
Deepa Kumar, you're a professor at Rutgers, fighting the good fight, trying to disinvite Condoleezza Rice, who condoned, facilitated, and ultimately sought to justify torture. They want her to be the commencement speaker. You and the faculty and students are fighting against it. May 18th is the big day. We want to check back with you to find out whether she gets disinvited or whether our listeners might want to show up at the commencement at Rutgers. So in the meantime, we are very grateful for you being on Law and Disorder. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Michael, and thank you for covering this issue.
Thank you, Deepa. Really appreciate it.
Bye-bye, Deepa.
Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.